sorry.
Good morning, dear hearts, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. As you can see, we have a small panel today, and we are here to discuss the topic, Altruism is Charity and Charitableness. The way this panel will work is the first speaker will do like 7 minutes or so and give a general outline of what typically the common philosophies and religions of the world think about altruism and charity, charitableness. After that, the second panelist will discuss the theosophical point of view of the same topic. Hopefully it's the same topic. And that will last about 7 minutes or so. After which there'll be ample time for your questions, comments, and answers. I'll draw your attention now to the inside of our periodical. And on the inside of the periodical, you'll see that we have all of the meetings listed for a 3-month period of time. You'll see that the titles are there and the dates of those meetings are there. You'll see that there are 2 meetings a week at this lodge. There are meetings on Wednesday evenings beginning at 7:45, ending at 9 sharp. The doors open at 5:30, and from 5:30 to 7:30, there is a reference library available, and there's always someone there to help you find the study material you require. So the Wednesday meetings are a study class, and we're presently studying In the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And presently, we are studying the after-death states, and in 2 weeks, we'll pick it up with the study of Devakan. Next Wednesday is a special Wednesday meeting. It is a devotional meeting, and we ask that you come about 5 minutes earlier or so and quietly take a seat. It is a devotional meeting with the life and times of William Q. Judge, one of the founders of the Theosophical movement. The following Wednesday, we'll pick up again with our study in the ocean. Now, the Sunday meeting, which apparently you all know about, begins at 11 o'clock sharp, ends at 12 o'clock. Doors open at 10:30. The topics on Sundays are all listed in the program, and they are typically more practical, the practical application of the philosophy of theosophy. I guess that pretty much studies takes care of the announcements. One thing I'd like to call your attention to is the back of the periodical. The back of the periodical, in writing, is the United Lodge of Theosophists Declaration. It is what all the lodges on this planet have in common. It is the foundation. It is our bond. And in 6 brief statements, all rolled into one to become the declaration. Now, typically on a Sunday, we will paraphrase the declaration, but we think it's too important. It doesn't give it the justice to do that. So I will read the declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, and the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Okay, today's topic. Let's begin. Early in the 19th century, a French philosopher by the name of Auguste Comte was writing an essay which he hoped would help the French people to get the pieces of their lives together, as it was just after the French Revolution had ended. Auguste Comte is the father, the developer, the inventor of a philosophy called positivism. Well, he was writing this essay, and he wrote one sentence, and that sentence was, "Individuals have a moral obligation to help, serve, and benefit others, and if necessary, even at the sacrifice of self-interest." Well, after he wrote that, he kind of had a brain freeze and didn't know what else to do right now. Because he knew that what he just wrote was a definition of something. Well, Roger's thesaurus was about 20 years away, and Noah's Webster's dictionary hadn't been distributed as yet. So he was kind of between a rock and a hard place, because he knew he had a very important thing he had written, but he didn't have a word for it. So he made one up. He took a French word and he took a Latin word, combined them, and we had the birth of the word altruism. So now that we have the definition, we have a word, how do we apply it? And is it practical? Is it something that can be accomplished on a daily basis? Some would say that it is nothing more than a new word for charity or almsgiving, perhaps even tithing. If you look at charity, you'll see that it's typically generous actions or donations to aid the poor, ill, or helpless. Almsgiving is anything given gratuitously to aid the poor, the ill, or helpless with clothing, food, money, a gift of charity. So the two are tied together. And tithing is a tenth part of one's annual income contributed to support the clergy or a church. The Mosaic Law required the Israelites to pay a tithe for the support of worship. If you take a look at the biblical definition of charity, it's a little different. When the King James translators came upon the Greek word agape, which means God's love, in addition to using the English word love to translate it, they often chose the word charity. This was meant to reinforce the idea that agape is a selfless, giving love. God's love is unselfish and unconditional. And there goes the definition of Christian love. Obviously, one of the big differences in Auguste Comte's definition of altruism and the biblical or common definition of charities is that there is no reference to God or to money or any type of reward in giving or putting to use the definition of altruism, as there is with biblical charity and almsgiving and tithing. For instance, tithing to a religious organization, you tithe for the glory of God. Giving to a charity because you're a kind person and you know they need your help. And by the way, you've been told that on Judgment Day, you'll get some reward. In Christianity, chapter 6 in Matthew, Matthew is a chapter, one of the Gospels in the New Testament, that has a lot of information about charity and giving and tithing and alms. So if you need to research anything, go to Matthew. When you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Again in Matthew, but chapter 10. He who receives a prophet because he is a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man because he is a righteous man will receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives to one of those little ones, even with a cup of water, because he is a disciple, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. So it looks like the major difference between Comte's altruism, and the religious charity is the motive or lack of a motive. Certainly, religious giving is the number one charity that people give money and material goods to. Estimated last year to be $100 billion. And that's just in the United States. Follow religious giving with people that give money to colleges, universities, and other educational institutions. People give money to the arts, to the humanities, and to other culturals. They also give money to victims of natural disasters. Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Rita raised billions of dollars for the help of those people. Lastly, giving is not confined to just money. People give all kinds of things. They give cars. They give clothes. They give food. Charity raises more questions than answers. When you give, is it better to give anonymously? And when you do your taxes, do you claim your charities as an itemized deduction? Is that anonymous? I'm sure you've heard enough of me. Let's get to the second part of this.
That pulse to do service and to be charitable and to act on the feeling of charity is a natural impulse across all human beings, across all times. And if we were to look beyond the Judeo-Christian background and look into Islam and into Hinduism, there are very finite statements about doing that. So it seems to be universal to all religions. If we look at the theosophical point of view on this, there are many, many writers, Wadia, Judge, Crosby among them, who talk about the living power of theosophy, of divine wisdom, that this is synthetic, that higher altruism is a part of this self-correction, that it grows from within on the part of each one and then results in growth for all externally. And that altruism, universal brotherhood, that impacted sense of charity and being kind, being empathetic, is actually impressed in the very nature of what it is to be human. A theosophical writer, Crosby, referred to super sensuous consciousness. Mr. Wadia talked about an energizing mind within. And if we look at very ancient historical documents like the Stanzas of Zan, you can find within that, on the cosmic level, the notion that at once, within the all from which we emanate, is desire first arose in it. And that desire is pure, unmitigated compassion. That is a desire that's the purest love, a sacrificial pulse, if you will, of limitless evolution and limitless potentiality and the service from the least to the grandest and back again, a full circle of life. Theosophically, the question of how do you make charity manifest in your life? If we all share a spiritual sense of wanting to give and wanting to assist, if that's part of the human spirit, then how do we best do that? How do we make this manifest in our lives, and how do we balance the needs of our own home, our own family, with the needs versus the wants of the greater society? Mr. Wadia wrote about making all of secular life holy. That literally, moment by moment, as we do the duties of our lives, as we mind beings move through life, we can move through from ignorance to learning to wisdom and bloom where we're planted. Mr. Wadia wrote that a good man lives the good life to the best of his ability and practices sattvic, wise, or holy sacrifices, and in time comes to understand the significance of how to do that and therefore to render endless, selfless service to humanity. HPB wrote an article, and it's in volume one of her collected articles, writing that as we look around at theosophy in general, we are reminded that of the original objects for the Theosophical Society in the late 1800s, charity was not one of those objects. Rather, it was presumed. If we think about the notion of universal brotherhood, of seeing each and all as ourselves, as seeing a limitless source of spirit behind each and all, then charity is created in that and presumed to exist, and that charity falls out literally with wisdom from this practice, from this strong conviction of universal brotherhood. HPB wrote in part, "The poor will always be with you. Misery cannot be relieved. It is a vital element in human nature, and it is as necessary to some lives as pleasure is to others. It takes a very wise man to do good works without danger of doing incalculable harm. None of us knows the darkness which lurks in the depths of our natures until some strange and unfamiliar experience arouses the whole being into action. So with these others who seem more miserable than ourselves, pain is a friend and a teacher." And therein we have the frame for the theosophical point of view of what would a Christ, what would a Buddha do? What's the discernment that's needed to empower rather to enable, to expand the other's ability to help themselves, not to take the duty away from another? Well, we've got lots, in fact, pages of quotes on how to be practical in our charity, how to extend a helping hand in a selfless way. And all of those things are outward manifestations. In the Gita, in the Eastern Hindu traditions, we see a statement frequently that says, seek wisdom by doing service. That by doing service to others, by maintaining a serenity of mind, a moderation, a mildness of temper, of maintaining silence and self-restraint, and being able to listen and learn and gradually get a wisdom about how life happens in terms of karma, cause and effect, we gradually purify our natures and are able to assist in better and better ways. The American educator John Holt wrote an article that was published in an old book called The Manus Reader. "A child is willing to tolerate misunderstanding, suspend judgment, wait for patterns to emerge, for enlightenment to come to him, to learn by continuous revelation, not by analysis and memorization alone, but yet by an infection, if you were, of virtues that allow them to practice and then ponder." So true altruism then, practical altruism from a theosophical point of view, is far more than external material works of charity and service. It's far more than what can be quantified. If we are here to develop a mutual tolerance, a mutual empathy, a mutual charity, We will be patient with the shortcomings of another. We will ungrudgingly offer help in the search for truth in all departments of nature, moral and physical, and we will consider what it is to exemplify brotherly love, to live on that aspect. And in that, the theosophical teaching is asking us to acknowledge that within each of us, there is a spiritual domain. There is a God within, literally. And that if we make our efforts to purify our character and purify our use of life and turn to that voice of the conscience within, very gradually we'll understand when to bestow a gift at a proper time, in a proper way, to another human being. What it means to have a motive that has absolutely nothing to do with reward or recognition. What it is to be, what's dangerous about giving a gift out of time and out of season, out of place. And ultimately speaking, then, if each of us, as we're here in life, use our predominant gifts to the best advantage of all, and we don't impede our fellow in using his or her predominant gifts, if we follow the methods of nature, we know that in nature we can find a nucleus. We find a seed that blooms and roots and produces in a particular location. So if where we're planted, if where we are, we open ourselves to the notion of universal brotherhood and the pure desire of wanting to serve and assist others, our duties will come to us. And at that point, we will know hand to hand, mouth to ear, eye to eye, heart to heart, how to help those closest to us help themselves so that they in turn are better able to help and teach others. If we can't find a nucleus, a volunteer group, we don't have a huge family, if we're living in relative isolation, we don't have strong neighborhood ties, then the very least we can do, and probably the very purest, simplest thing we can do, is to begin within our heart of hearts, to become a nucleus, to become centered, to become a point of radiation of love and practical assistance, and trust the law, trust karma, that those opportunities to give charity will come to us. And having said that, there are three skillion quotes that we could talk about in Q&A.
Yes.
Just to address for a moment the issue on itemizing deductions, an older student told us if your motive isn't to do that, your motive is to be charitable, of course you should itemize. It's legal, and take the money you get back and use it in a charitable way. So We should itemize. That's all.
Okay, that's a good comment. Nobody brought up the fact before that itemize and use the money when you get it back for other charitable.
Nice one, nice spin.
Let's keep it rolling. Yes.
We often wondered about the phrase in the Gita about gifts given out of time and place and season. If we're moved to make a gift of whatever kind to someone, some organization, whatever it might be, how could it be out of time or out of place? If something in us moves us to do that, just by being altruistic, how could that be wrong?
Well, if we theorize that we have this source within, this impulse to be and this impulse to give and to do. We know that Madison Avenue and advertisers are really, really slick at preying on that kind of natural impulse. And if somebody mindlessly just goes with that as a reflex. The money can wind up going into agencies where it's a not-for-profit on paper only, but 90% or 80% of the money actually goes to incomes and to management of the entire process. So if we take some time, if we recognize the impulse and we have the time to consider it, to do the research on the agencies, to make sure that they're using less than 10% of the money brought in for incomes or et cetera, we're in better shape. But the other anecdote that comes to mind is there was a pretty famous missionary in the 1800s who was living in a South Seas island setting. And really, from the bottom of his toes to the top of his being, he was watching a clan spend decades making knives. The males of the, start from children to adulthood, making knives. And they were very primitive knives, and they broke easily, and it was just this lifelong agony of trying to produce a knife. So for Christmas that year, the Christian missionary, acting on very, very kind-hearted motive, the highest of motives, bought the best knives imaginable from the United States, had them shipped in, and gave them to each male. And in fact, gave some to some of the females in the clan too. And within a couple decades, the entire clan was gone. The reason being was that in their natural setting, what it meant to be a man was symbolized by the development of this weapon to be used for the good of a home. And all of the role assignments in the family structures were set up around duties and the complementary set of roles. And by giving everybody a knife ready-made, all of that value system was wiped out, destroyed, and all of a sudden there was no need to marry because everybody had their own knives for their own uses. It just got very ugly very, very quickly, and it's an extreme example. But acting with wisdom and acting in a timely but a rational way honors boundaries for self-fulfilled and self-devised efforts.
Yes.
Another application of that too is even among the homeless, to give someone money who has a destructive habit without thinking about it, and not only homeless, even among our own families in some instances, is to be very careless because you're giving them the wherewithal to take what is a bad habit and make it lethal. So it's a certain awareness on your part on what it is that you're contributing to.
Yeah, it's doing your homework. You're, in that particular instance, you're talking about enabling.
Yes.
Mm. Yes, in the back.
But if someone in a difficult condition puts their hand out and asks me for money, I respond from my own gut. I don't think, oh, they'll probably use it on drugs or something. I don't think that way. Sometimes I will automatically say no. I don't question that. But when I give, and how they use it is their choice. So I don't agree with that argument unless we know for certain that someone is going to use the money in a way.
Well, I thought that was the implication, that he knew that it would be used for a bad purpose.
Yeah, and certainly context and duty comes directly to you. Someone on the street comes directly to you. If the individual is obviously high or in withdrawal, you've got some information about how it might be used. It's possible to take the money, get a sandwich, come back and give a sandwich to the individual. There are ways to mitigate, and sometimes just looking into the eyes of the other and recognizing the humanity and offering a good wish. Not today, buddy, but I wish you well, all the best. Sometimes that gift of we are one is the greatest recognition of all. The other thing that, some of the tragedy with the folks on the street is there is an element of the population who have mental challenges, emotional challenges, and in fact they have SSI checks coming to them in bank accounts, but they, because of their handicaps, won't go into the buildings, don't trust to go get the cash. It's a big dilemma in society. HPB's advice frequently was hand to hand, person to person. And that way you have a chance to build your own intuition, who can use the help this way, who can use the help that way, and you have more control over that one-to-one empathy, which is so important.
Mr. Wayu, in the same vein, quotes an ancient saying that if a beggar comes to your door asking to have his rice bowl filled, don't send your servant, but you go yourself.
Right.
Exactly right. That's the same as the HPV's hand to hand. Yes, in the back.
And the other thing is we have that faculty of using our discrimination. Sometimes we might move too quickly to do, and we should be able to discriminate. Are we doing too much and taking away from that other person's individuality of doing it himself, or are we doing too little?
Yeah, you can't make the decisions for them. You can only make your own decision. If you're going to do it, you do it. And whatever they do, that's what they do. You can't be responsible for the gift you gave and the way they use the gift you gave.
I can remember back in when I was a teenager, this topic was on my mind for such a long time. And I believe back then, I was like, well, there's no such thing as altruism, because even people that are being seemingly altruistic, they're only doing things which are going to make themselves feel better anyway. Mm-hmm. So I still haven't come to a resolution with that, because even if it's just now that I may have some more knowledge and I know that actually doing something for somebody is actually going to make me feel better than doing something for myself, is that truly being given? You know, I haven't figured out the answer to that one yet.
Uh-huh. If motive becomes the entire coloring agent of this entire thing, if any of us in service professions in particular, whether it's in the classroom or in the protection agencies or in hospitals or where any service agency at all, there is a sense of fulfillment that comes with doing a service and seeing the results of that. And in that moment of fulfillment, where we can catch ourselves, wow, there was that little tint of that motive that this is going to be good, or I can do some good, or this feels good to do this. There's the opportunity to ponder a little bit, to meditate a little bit, and to look at the nature of the motive. And the very process of being introspective, of saying, well, this came to me, my initial motive was to do X for the other person, and the radiation that comes, the side effect of that is also this other feeling, still the other person was assisted, that's the only thing that's important. That process of thinking about that is also a service. It raises the mind of the entire population and it colors the entire situation. And as long as we don't trumpet, hey, look what I did. I mean, sometimes we'll hear ourselves or a good friend, you know, I did X, Y, and Z. Or so-and-so thinks I'm really good because I did X, Y, and Z. There we see the cringing of vanity creeping in. But that anonymity, that saying, whoops, there's a mixed motive there. I see what it is. Okay, I still did all right. We'll let go of it. And next time I'll try to do it without this extra feeling. That may be the help to the dilemma. Yeah.
Well, we would think having that feeling is good. That here we are, we're making a connection with another human being. That when we say feeling, we're talking about our psychic nature. You know, that we're connected to all of life on that plane. Mm-hmm. And that when we do something that reaffirms that we are a part of something else, that person that I'm giving to is me. I'm giving this, you know, and it, something wells up within all of us that we feel somewhat satisfied or feel good.
The other thing, the comment is also a springboard to another thought, which is it's a spectrum. We are in evolution. We are who we are right now. So that if we are moving from selfish to self-centered to away from self-serving towards selflessness, it's a continuum of learning, isn't it? That's what springs to mind with what you're saying. And that along those ways, some of that fulfillment, for want of a better word, some of that emotionality is probably a guidepost on that path of learning.
It's a perpetuation of universal brotherhood. And is it okay to have a good feeling? Sure. It's a mutual benefit. And that's okay. To the left.
Sometimes we need to learn to love ourselves first. Not in an inflated way, but just in a realistic way. To just feel a part of humanity and a part of the whole. Not less than. Often we feel when we don't achieve certain goals, that makes us less than. And we think that just having a right attitude towards oneself and feeling a part of it all and really loving oneself, then we're more able to reach out and love others.
Well, if you don't, you're going to sit in a room and you might as well have a padded cell. Because you're going to sit there and just keep beating on yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you got to come around. Are you going to feel better once you commit yourself to a spiritual path, a path of spiritual wisdom and enlightenment? Sure, you make that decision, and that makes you feel good. Is it wrong to do that? I mean, every time you take a baby step in the right direction, you don't pat yourself on the back. You just keep on going.
The other thing that comes to mind is that the psychologist Maslow had a whole hierarchy of needs, and among them were security and nutrition and affiliation, the sense of belonging. And it was only after all these individual needs were met that he posited that at that point then there could be a self-fulfilling individual who, because all the basic needs were met and cared for, self-care, that then this individual would bloom as spirit and be able to create and to do things for others. And in William Q. Judge's letters that have helped me, there's a whole series of letters that are at once extremely simple but very profound. You know, it's really, really good stuff. And he writes about remaining silent, meditating, becoming centered, caring, raising the self by the self, turning within to be introspective, so that by making no set plan and by being watchful, aware, or open, then you can use your predominant gifts to the best advantage for all. So there is this process of self-care, centering, and I guess loving one's nature and then blooming with it. Yeah.
Going back for a moment to the sense of fulfillment in being charitable, because we all are one, that is the most natural feeling in the world, The problem is when we are not honest with ourselves and we allow our personal nature to take the credit for what's a spontaneous thing. And we think there are ways to remind yourself. That would be like thinking your shoes are the dancer. They're not. They're a tool you use. So we have to learn who we really are as spiritual beings and then realize the rest of it is just our instruments for action.
An excellent point. Thank you.
Excellent point.
Yes.
Last week we talked about detachment and renunciation. And I think it kind of applies in this case in a way, because I don't think there's any shame in feeling good about doing something charitable for somebody. I think, you know, we're all under a duty to act and give wisely, so that it actually has its intended effect. But in terms of detachment, I think it's important to detach yourself from what comes of that at some point. I mean, you do your act and you feel good about it, but I think detachment in this case means sort of divorcing yourself from any expectation of return that would lead to some sort of self-righteousness, because I think that that's where the failure occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Gita is full of that philosophy right there. Just as you said, divorce yourself from any result, good or bad.
In Crosby's writing, there's a little phrase, do your duty by each duty and then leave the results to the law, leave it to karma. And it certainly must be a real dilemma for the incredibly wealthy, you know, that less than 1% of the individuals who are setting up public foundations trying to figure out how to be a good steward of the wealth coming to them, then how do you put it back out without the personal vanity, without in a detached fashion? There's laughter.
Well, we always loved Mr. Crosby's remark when a student said, oh, if only I had more time and more money, all the good things I would do. And he said, what you should ask yourself is, what do you do with the time and the money you have now? And then you'll see clearly how charitable you are.
Yeah.
In doing some reading on this subject, I came across a quote or a question by, and it was entitled by an anonymous sage rabbi. And the question was, if you are giving to a charity, would you write them a check for $365, that's $1 a day, or would you take them $1 a day? Is there a difference? And the answer that the sage gave was that you develop a sense of giving by doing it on a daily basis. And that's why the Jewish homes have a little box called pushka. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And it is a box, and it's usually on a shelf somewhere in the kitchen. And change, loose change, goes in that box. And when the box is full, the family has a meeting to decide where it goes. And when it's empty, they put another box out there and do the same thing. And it's a family's way of always giving. They feel that everything they have is a gift from God. They are the stewards of that gift. And if they don't give it wisely, they won't get it to begin with. Yes.
Just to go back to what I was saying before, a little bit more in depth. I think that for me, it's important for me to find a way not to feel superior and self-righteous to everybody else out there. And in this way, I think thinking the way that I'm trying to think, it helps me be compassionate for other people. For example, now that I know that it's actually going to make me feel better to do things for other people, I believe that everybody is just doing what they're doing because they're on their own path to try to find this feeling of peace. So right now they think that just hoarding money and everything is going to give them peace, but they're no different than me because they're just kind of searching for that feeling, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe I have a little more knowledge now. So I think that's also what I was trying to communicate.
The religious folks frequently will say, but for the grace of God, there go I. And part of life, part of the empathy, is to look within each of these paths and say, gee, is that any different? One of the most extreme examples probably is in the world of Islam with multiple wives. The origin of the practice, when Muhammad walked the earth, there was horrible things going on against widows and orphans. Horrific things in the desert where resources were very narrow. Things were very, very bad. Poverty was incredible. The original institutional teaching in the Sharia was that if your brother dies, take in his widow as an additional wife. You are responsible in the surviving household to care for these other women. You come across an orphan, same thing, expand the family circle and do charity. Take care of the all. Well, we know to what extremes that can go and how twisted and perverse that can become generations later, centuries later, both in the East and the West. But if we look into the origin of the teaching, we can find a particular application of compassion and charity and altruism, and perhaps find, as this comment is finding, that no matter how different we appear in terms of practice, if we can look into the heart of the impulse and talk together about the impulse that is shared, the differences disappear and the unity of that supreme universal brotherhood is surfaced and strengthened. Yeah.
We're talking more or less on this outer plane of charity, but often the most difficult thing to do is having charity for someone else's shortcomings, for their idiosyncrasies, for their personality things that they do to get attention or to do this or to do that. We seem to find fault with all that. We lose our charity within our own heart because we think that they are against us and not with us.
And it seems to be the more that we care about somebody, the closer proximity we are together, there can be more friction along the line of that intolerance. Theosophy offers a little reader called The Voice of the Silence. And in that, around page 9 or so, the various virtues are outlined. And the first one is Dana, the key of charity, consideration for another, no matter what the state. So the theosophic point of view would be to feel the friction, recognize that it's there, be aware of it, and then think about it. How come? What about this event or that person is driving me nuts? Why is so-and-so pushing my buttons? Or why do I push their buttons? What's that about? And the process of being introspective and thinking about it and seeking that answer raises that charity to a different level. The second key would be the key of Sheila, harmony in word and deed. It's one thing to think altruism, charity, charitableness. It's a whole nother thing to move past the friction, to move past the practical in and out of it, into a harmony where we're walking our talk, practicing what we preach. And then a third key of the many is Shante, the patience sweet that none can ruffle. You know, as Americans, we're like, okay, hurry up. I've made a resolution. I've given something up for this Lent, whatever it is. Overnight, boom, that should be it. Not at all. Yeah.
Another theosophical expression of this uncharitableness towards the problems of others is that it is a mirror, and what we're seeing is our own problem manifested in them, and we don't want to see it because we don't want to fix it. So whenever someone irritates you, you have to mentally say thank you and then go to work on yourself. the other point where you said about the buttons.
Oh.
They are our own buttons.
Yes.
If it's your buttons, how can somebody else be pushing them? So we have to come to realize we're pushing them and why we're pushing them.
Yes.
And we're thinking about trying to expand that idea of charity beyond just our brothers and sisters, but to all of nature. And what came to mind was a piece in the Mahabharata, the Indian epic. And there's, after the battle has been done and there are very few left surviving, the last brother dies and he's got with him his dog, his favorite animal on earth. And they're walking and they come to a gate and he says, "Is this heaven?" And the keeper says, "Yes, but you can't bring the dog in." He says, "I will walk on." This happens two or three times, and at the last gate, the keeper says to him, "This was your final test. Of course you would not leave anyone or anything out." And the lesson is that we expand that idea of charity to all of life, to look into the eyes of everyone and look at everything as being connected to us. And that's more of a global consciousness that we think we are engendering these days. We're becoming more aware.
The example's an excellent one, because in that case, we know as enlightened companion to our four-footed little buddies, they really do need protection and enlightened guidance and companionship. Where we have to be careful is in the two-legged world, where we can cripple somebody else up by overextending our own direction or talents or whatever. We may actually be stifling the other from growing their own talents. So it's a discernment is really the key word. Your hand's been up.
And I wanted to say one more thing. Environmental and animal protection causes, charities, are the number three in the nation. People give $30 billion last year to animal rights and environmental protection.
Yet so much of the hour was devoted to, you know, who to and how to offer, give, share, you know, physical things, the money, the whole thing. But isn't it the case that a student of theosophy, forget the money side of it, but on the plane of thought, really, our wealth is unlimited. And those in our families or other circles who naturally put their hand out and ask questions, what student would ever not answer the question to the best of his ability and disown the credit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so because perhaps others have heard, "Wow, you're so smart, how do you know all that?" Really, the answer always is, "I read it in a book. I mean, mm-hmm. it makes sense to me, take it or leave it, but you've given it, you know?" And so perhaps, you know, those who are so further along the path in so many ways than any of us, on whatever plane, they really get it. They know it's all unlimited, whether it's anything from the physical to the spiritual or whatever. And it could be that just as we would not even consider not sharing a theosophical view with a friend or a relative if they ask for it, so too would those further on the path who have a better understanding of reality can give anything that they have, because in every way for them, really everything is unlimited and they've fully realized that.
Well, our time is just about past. In Crosby's Friendly Philosopher, there's a wonderful statement on page 7 that unselfish desire to benefit others without anxiety about our own progress is the key. Strive at all times to be better able to help and teach others in help that leaves perfect freedom for thought and action among all. So there's a nice keystone for the week. Go out and be charitable. Have a great day.